Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we turn our attention to horror film Hereditary and hear from the writer-director Ari Aster. And as a bonus treat, we'll later be hearing from the one and only Rupert Everett, who talks to us about his directorial debut and starring role in his Oscar Wilde biopic, The Happy Prince. I'm Sam Howlett, and joining me this week are three co-hosts. First up, an overbearing matriarch who will no doubt haunt us from beyond the grave. It's Steph Watts.
Hello.
Hello. And a troubled young man who's been decapitating birds all morning, Stephen Ryder.
Hello.
Hello. And making his pod debut, where we all walked into the studio on the floor, he scuttled across the ceiling and lingered in the corner for an unsettling amount of time. From Trafalgar Releasing, it's Ollie Charles.
Hey there.
Welcome, Ollie.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we're going to talk Hereditary now. The film premiered at Sundance in January, and very quickly word spread about how scary the film is and people are fainting and walking out. And the poster quote even says, you know, it's this generation's The Exorcist. So, guys, what have you heard about the film before you saw it, and how did it meet those expectations?
Being compared to The Exorcist is a bit crazy, right? Like, for your debut film. I think the publicity for the film has been very interesting in that regard, in that they've really been pushing this as not only a really scary film that audiences should go see if they want to be scared, but something that kind of has a place at the top of the pantheon already. And I'm not sure if that's a positive or negative thing, but it's certainly creating the buzz that it needs for good box office. But when you guys walked into the film, were you aware of this kind of comparison?
I think the only things I knew about the film, so I hadn't even watched the trailer, so I knew that the trailer was meant to be this like really scary trailer that were causing people to, you know, get really excited about it. I hadn't even watched the trailer. All I knew was Toni Collette at the top of her game.
Yep.
It was the scariest thing that I was ever going to watch.
Yeah.
Which so many people, like literally as I was walking into the screen, people who I know had seen it were saying, oh my God, you're going to find this too much. And I mean, I love horror, but I was expecting to either watch the whole thing behind my hand or myself. So I was really like this is going to be too much for me.
So when it premiered at Sundance, I like immediately went and read some reviews. All the reviews were so much like, my heart was pounding, scariest movie I've ever seen in my life type thing. I was like, yes, I'm ready. And then obviously when I got into the cinema, I was just filled with anxiety. Like, am I sure I actually want to do this?
it immediately starts with this kind of super slow, doom-laden kind of camera tilt. And you really want the movie to start hurrying up in a way, because it's almost too much tension immediately.
Yeah.
But it never really, I think, gets out of that mode, until like the kind of crescendo at the end. But it's got this amazing like tone to it and rhythm that really pulls you along and warns you at the same time. So
yeah, I think the tension is so great. Well, with a lot of horror films that I've been to see in the cinema, you have that tension and then you have a jump scare and kind of everybody jumps and screams and then like has a good laugh because it's released the tension because you've like had the jump. But with this, there's like hardly any jump scares. It's just tension, tension, tension. Just like the screw tightening for 2 hours. Just, it's quite intense.
Yeah, no catharsis or anything. So the film is about the Graham family, who, after the death of their secretive monarch, begin to experience strange occurrences that lead them to uncover sinister secrets about their ancestry. That's a pretty vague plot. It's pretty much the plot of maybe 50% of all horror films. So that's, and I think that's all you should know going in. We were talking before we started recording about what should we say, and we think we all agreed, you know, the less plot specific we get, the better, because this is a film that really does pull the rug from under you several times. Stephen, you spoke to Ari Aster.
Yes, yeah. Absolute gentleman. Really nice. Really nice guy. You would not expect
I know.
After this film, but yeah.
Do you want to talk about some of his short films? Because this is his debut feature, but he has made a name for himself with some short films. I'm thinking in particular Munchausen and The Strange Thing About the Johnsons.
So I haven't seen Munchausen. I hear it's got a lot in common, actually, with Hereditary, but right. I have seen The Strange Thing About the Johnsons, and it's an incredibly disturbing film in a very different way. Mm-hmm. It's still got this tension to it. It's still got this kind of like ratcheting up of tension that he seems to really enjoy putting the audience through. I think he always seems to have the audience in mind when he's making a film, which is more than you can say for a lot of the directors these days. But the Strange Thing About the Johnsons is a film about another secret that a family has, mm-hmm. that in a way is a little bit more disturbing than Hereditary on the surface level, because it's a more realistic kind of it's a story about sexual abuse. It's a story about kind of like the ties that bind family together that are broken, snapped, mm-hmm. and it's a cruel film in a lot of ways. But I think it's you can tell that Ari Aster is someone who's very, very much in control of his craft, and I think that's how he sees himself as a director as well. And I think that it's so rare to get somebody like that into the horror genre so quickly, but it seems to be happening more and more often these days. And I think these short films like The Strange Thing About the Johnsons are a really good platform to recognize new directors mm-hmm. coming up in horror. And I think he's just been signed up by A24 for another horror film. So evidently, you know, I think this will be four in a row if you count his short films. So maybe, you know, we've got a new kind of voice of horror in the industry.
Excellent. So without further ado then, this is Stephen talking to writer-director Ari Aster.
Thank you for joining us here today, Ari.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's probably a long press tour for you guys, because the film's getting quite ahead of steam right now, I think.
It's been exhausting, but it's been really gratifying.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, when you... it's surprising to me, because I've seen the film and it's kept me up for the last couple of days. So it's surprising that people still want to see it after all the kind of things that they're hearing about it, because it truly is quite a terrifying experience. When you first started work on the project, did you envisage it as kind of getting this kind of buzz?
I certainly fantasized about, you know, I think a lot of filmmakers, you know, that's how they get through it, because it's so hard to make a film mm-hmm. and it takes so long.
Yes.
And there's so much stress involved that sometimes you just, it's like, okay, you fantasize about, you know, people watching it and appreciating it, and it gets you through. But no, I would say, you know, it's been a really nice surprise, but it has been a surprise, because we always knew that we were making something potentially alienating, mm-hmm. but something that ultimately, you know, a film whose primary aim was to upset the audience in a very deep way. And so it's been nice to see that people, you know, are into that.
I think that's great that you're kind of very open about that, because it's when you first kind of step into a horror film, and like one like this, you never quite know how scary it's going to be. But I think from the first 5 minutes of this one, you kind of know straight away that you're in for a bit of an intense experience. And that's what I was really impressed by, is that you kind of seem to have a knack for getting under the audience's skin as a director. Do you think that that's something that you're going to kind of stick with, or do you think the horror genre is kind of a one and done thing for you?
Well, you know, I love the horror genre. And when I was a kid, especially, you know, 12, 13, 14, I was obsessed with horror films, and I would exhaust the horror section of every video store I could find. But I haven't been anything resembling a devotee for the last decade or so, and this is because so many horror films are, you know, produced so cynically these days, mm-hmm. and there are always exceptions, and there have been a lot of exceptions recently. For me, the most notable one might be a brilliant South Korean film called The Wailing.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it's so great. Mm-hmm. But then Let the Right One In, The Witch, mm-hmm. The Babadook. These are really wonderful films.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
But at the same time, I mean, what distinguishes almost all of them is that they are also like honoring these older traditions. They are taking time. They are making sure that the films are rooted in a place of character, mm-hmm. and they're thematically rich and interesting. And I and that's nothing new. I mean, my favorite horror films are probably Rosemary's Baby, mm-hmm. and Don't Look Now. I see Hereditary as being sort of a spiritual cousin to Don't Look Now in a lot of ways.
I think that's really interesting, actually, because I was thinking as I was watching Hereditary that does have this kind of genealogy with the kind of family horror film. And that's Rosemary's Baby and Don't Look Now are both films that deal with the idea of family as a terrifying thing rather than as a warm, comforting thing.
As a dangerous thing.
Yeah, as a dangerous thing. And I think your short film, The Strange Thing About the Johnsons, also dealt with family as well. Yeah. So is that a theme that kind of appeals to you, making films about family and about the things that can go wrong within the family dynamic?
Well, I think just... as a dramatist, it's just great fodder, because ultimately, who are we closer to than the people in our family, mm-hmm. for the same reason, you mm-hmm. know, what relationships are more insidious, a betrayal in a family, like a family member betraying somebody within that family, I mean, is so much more devastating, right? Than a friend betraying you, mm-hmm. or even a lover, mm-hmm. right? And I think a big part of that is also because, there is no extricating yourself from family. You can, yep. but ultimately, those ties are impossible to sever in other ways.
Yes, because in Hereditary, we have, obviously there is a supernatural element to it, but some of the kind of scenes that get under your skin the most are the scenes where of things we don't see, of things that have happened before in the family, between Toni Collette's character and her son. And I think that it's really important that a horror film such as this one kind of focuses not just on the kind of supernatural, that it goes a little bit deeper and it looks into how these dynamics have been working before all these kind of other things come along.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. I mean, even when I first started writing the film, I had to investigate, well, what am I afraid of? And mm-hmm. I'm not a particularly superstitious person. Mm-hmm. So the supernatural stuff doesn't really scare me either. What scares me are like my fears are more existential, and I do consider the film to be something of an existential horror film.
Absolutely.
But my fears are, are things that really don't have any remedy. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you do with a fear of death? You either come to terms with it or you don't. Mm-hmm. What do you do with a fear of abandonment? Like, or the suspicion that you can't really ever really know anybody.
Yeah, yeah,
Which is true. Like, you can't. I mean, not on some levels, like you can't really know anybody else's experience. And so I ultimately wanted to make a film that was, that sort of served as a serious meditation on grief and trauma while also, functioning as I hope a satisfying, genre exercise. But in some ways I think the film owes a greater debt to the domestic melodrama than it does to the horror film. Because this is a film that really is about suffering, and it's a film that really hopes to take these characters' pain very seriously, and it even hopes to honor the extreme emotions that these people are going through by ultimately being as big as them. Like, the film is expressionistic in that way,
and unbelievably so.
Trying to match the feelings in the film in its form,
which kind of like is. I see now why, looking at Toni Collette, it's kind of the perfect casting for that kind of film, a melodrama that kind of seeps into horror.
Yeah.
What was it like getting Toni on board for this? How difficult was it, or was she like raring to go?
I mean, really, we sent her the script, and I attached a letter to it, and she read it, and she responded to it. We met for lunch, we got along, and she attached herself. And you know, and it was very clear. I think, you know, I know that she knew right away, because it was on the page, just how demanding the part would be, and she knew what was required of her, and you know, so she came on pretty quickly. We were shooting the film in, you know, less than a year after she came on. But really my, you know, my work as a director was really in casting her, because from there, you know, she knew what needed to happen, and she mm-hmm. just dove in,
yeah,
you know, nose first. And so really, you know, I can be kind of dictatorial in my blocking, but emotionally, I really just got to stand at the monitor and be a fan and just watch her go.
That's great. That's great. Because it is a fantastic performance. And I think it shows that she feels very comfortable with this script and comfortable with this character. And I think that's probably a lot down to the direction as well. So it's quite impressive.
Okay. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was the film as a horror film. So I wanted to ask, like, you know, obviously, Ollie, you've already said you're a big horror fan. I know, Stephen, I know you're a big horror fan. Are you up on horror, Steph?
I try to watch it, even though it terrifies me.
That's the fun of it.
Yeah.
So what kind of horror film is Hereditary? How much of a horror film is it? How sort of genre literate do you think the film is trying to be?
It's definitely not what I was expecting it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's far more intelligent. And it's far more, it's so well put together, as you were referencing earlier. Like, it's such an incredibly well-made film, which for the most part, you know, with a lot of horror films, like, you can enjoy them. And as you know, we spoke about the jump scares and all that sort of stuff, but you don't necessarily go, wow, that was actually a really well-made film that you can kind of come away and go,
yeah.
Directing, great, lead actress, great, supporting cast, great. Like, and that's definitely what I came away with from Hereditary. Like, sure, I got scared. There was definitely a scene or two where I was watching it behind my hand. But, like, it's also just so much more. And I think the horror sometimes is grouped together as, like, a straight-to-DVD thing, or it's not necessarily seen as, like, high art.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily seen as, like, the genre that you must go and watch. But, like, you only have to see 5-star reviews for this everywhere and kind of go, actually, maybe we should take this one a bit more seriously.
Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot more of those now, though, right? Like, I think Hereditary is a film that it seems to be in this kind of peak moment of horror where it's existing. But I think it does owe a lot to films like The Witch. I think it owes a lot to films like The Babadook.
Yes.
Even though that's a film that I don't love, I think it does owe a lot to a film like The Babadook.
Definitely.
And even stuff like It Follows as well, which this is kind of on a different level, I think, cinematically to something like It Follows. But these are all films, I think, horror films in the last 5-6 years, which have kind of taken that step towards telling people that the genre isn't dead, mm-hmm. and that there are kind of young, like, auteurs that can really, like, dip their toes into the genre and bring something really interesting out of it. So
yeah, I think as well, until quite recently with kind of It Follows and The Witch and films like that, I feel like horror's been quite like an audience-focused experience. Like, it doesn't really get a lot of awards recognition, and it's maybe not as kind of critically well received, but audiences, it has a huge audience following. But I feel like with films like Hereditary and some of these other kind of horror films that are starting to appear, it's more of like the director being like, what can I do with this genre, rather than how can I scare an audience for an hour and a half.
No, that's absolutely right. And I feel like this is the reason I say it's like at the peak, is because I feel like this movie is going to do so well. I'm seeing buzz for it everywhere.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is what they intended, but I'm seeing articles on the BBC referencing how scary this film is. And, you know, if you get eyes like that. I think Toni Collette was on Graham Norton recently talking about the film.
Yeah.
If you can get eyes like that on the film, I think horror has always been a genre that people will go to the cinema to see. They want that experience of seeing it in the cinema with other people. And it's because of that, this like visceral kind of experience of the horror film in a cinema environment, that I think that we're seeing lots of film companies take bigger risks now with horror films and give people like Ari Aster for his debut feature this kind of exposure, this kind of money to go out and make something, and it's paying off.
The best experience of you know, the best thing about watching the horror films in the cinema is that moment where you, whether it's a jump scare or whether it's something a bit more subtle, like in Hereditary, where you can, there was definitely a moment in the screen that I went to where something happens and everyone jumps and then suddenly laughed. And like, that's a great moment in the cinema because it's a shared experience. It's like, I think of all the genres now, horror, definitely, you know, in terms of the high quality that is coming out now, is probably, I mean, I would say it's one of the most fun things to watch in the cinema. It's
absolutely,
it really illustrates that like shared experience, the darkened room with a group of people who you don't know, and you're all feeling and being put through the same emotional turmoil, which you definitely feel with this film.
I saw this in a like a press screening, and usually I think they're a little bit more, they're a little bit quieter, they're a little bit more tame, they're a little bit more held back because they're, you know, they're there for work, they're professional. And I was thinking, I wish I saw this for the first time with an actual audience that paid to see it. But even with this, there was still a lot of and I could hear people going, "Oh no," things like that, and yeah. And that nervous. There was a lot of nervous laughter for the film, actually. Mm. Even though I think the trailer makes this look like quite an austere film, but I do think there is a strange sense of like cackling fun a lot of the time.
Definitely some super dark humor in there, isn't there?
Mm. I don't know if that was just my sense of that was my sense of view, but I do think there is an element of kind of, because things get quite at certain times quite ramped up, and I do think that made me kind of go, oh, okay, it's this kind of film.
I think everything with Joan has a funny edge to it. Joan being a woman that Annie.
So this is Anne Dowd's character.
Yeah, Anne Dowd, who's an incredible actress.
Yes.
Everything with her, she plays it so well because she knows how almost stereotypically horror this character is. This kind of like strange older woman who's into the kind of mystical arts, as far as I'll go.
Yeah.
But she plays it up and she hams it up so much. And I think Ari Aster is very clever to not let this become a self-serious film in that way. Like, there are moments where, as an audience, you're thinking, like, how far is this going to go? How far are they going to take this? And they keep pushing it, and they keep pushing it. And there is that kind of, like, funny edge to that, I think. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Like, the whole time with the Anne Dowd character, with Joan, you're like, well, I mean, I was sat there being, and it's exactly what you're saying about what was happening in that press screening. I was like, to Annie Graham, to the Toni Collette character, I was like, no, don't talk to her. Don't get in her car. Don't go into her flat. Like, we all know what's going to happen, so don't do it.
And if you've seen The Leftovers or The Handmaid's Tale, don't trust Anne Dowd.
Never trust her. But in a way, I think we can laugh about that, but I think it kind of does illustrate how desperate and grief-stricken Annie is at that point in the film, after, you know, the death of her mother. And we kind of you kind of get it, and that's the sad part, I think, of her experience in the film, is that all these mistakes that she does make, that horror characters make sometimes, become kind of believable.
I think this is why it, for me, like, when I was watching it, the biggest comparison, or recent comparison, because I know that obviously, you know, the reviews are talking about things like The Exorcist, but for me the most recent comparison was The Babadook. So because it felt real, and I honestly think that that's probably the thing that is the most scary, is you can take away, as with any horror film or any film full stop, but you can strip out ghosts and ghouls and demons and whatever, and you know, but at the end of the day, it's at its center a real something that the emotions that they're feeling are real life. They're things that people genuinely feel.
Yeah.
It's not all about ghosts and ghouls. It's about something. It's about the loss of a parent and the trauma that follows. And I think that that is what makes it so real. And for me, that was similar to The Babadook, is that it's this incredible mother son relationship, and that was real. And the horror came from that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what. Possibly when critics are saying this is the scariest film they've ever seen, and you know, this is the scariest thing of the decade, it's probably that, because it's real. It's not necessarily all quote unquote the horror stuff that you would expect.
I think Toni Collette does really well to actually convey that emotion throughout the film. I think the film leans quite heavily on her to do a lot of the exposition, so in all these kind of group therapy kind of sessions that she sneaks off to, she gives a lot of backstory to like her family, her mother and herself, just through these kind of really like long running single shots of her face and her telling us about her life. She does so well to like make it real and like bring the emotion to it.
Yeah, there's been some talk of a potential Oscar campaign for Toni Collette. It's very early to start talking about Oscar campaigns, but I think what's happened is after Get Out last year showed that not only a genre film, but a horror film can make a big impact. And that was, at one point, that was a sort of almost favourite for Best Picture, which is a huge deal for a horror film. Do you think Hereditary will have the same legs as Get Out? I know it probably won't be as... It's not as audience-friendly as Get Out, I suppose.
I think the film won't. It's not as audience-friendly, and it's not got the same charm to it that Get Out had. Mm-hmm. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. It's an intense kind of...
Hereditary is not trying to be charming in any way, shape,
exactly.
or form.
It's an intense experience. Not that Get Out wasn't, but this is like... It's a film that I think... I'm quite impressed that it's managed to kind of get into the mainstream in the way that it has so far. And I think Toni Collette's performance will, by the time the Oscars roll round, you can't ignore it. It's too... It just stands on this amazing precipice between... melodrama and horror and drama, where you feel like she's sliding too far into the melodramatic sometimes, and then she reins it back in, she pulls it back in, and she's got these amazing facial contortions and expressions that she uses that I haven't seen from an actor in a long time. It's a very naked, like, kind of performance, the way that she uses her face. She does not care one jot about how gruesome or grotesque or ugly she looks at some points in the film. And I think you can't ignore that when it comes around to Oscar seasons, because there'll be some clean performances that get nominated, and hers deserves to be put against those to show, like, this is a different kind of performance.
Yeah,
it's physical, it's visceral, you know?
Just like looking at the key images that are being used for the film, there's that one image which I think is the one that I've seen the most of Toni, with like her, it's like the real extreme close-up to her face, and her mouth's open and she's sweaty and crying, and it's like, you very rarely see that full stop as a key image used for, you know, to promote a film. But also, it's not any old actress. You know, it's Toni Collette. We all know her. She's been, you know, she's been in amazing films for years now. Maybe from a newer actress who's willing to take a bit more of a risk, you might see a shot like that being used. But it's actually really rare, I think, for someone of her stature. I'm all here for her being nominated for an Oscar, because it was an unbelievable performance.
Yeah.
Best female performance I've yet seen this year.
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison between what she's doing here and what she did in The Sixth Sense as well, because that's another kind of a horror film that kind of took people by surprise and became this massive hit, and she's playing this sort of grief-stricken mother struggle, and her performance is very much between, you know, horror and melodrama, and trying to combine these two to make it give herself like a realistic interaction with these supernatural forces. And yeah, I think she's knocked it out of the park. I think she's incredible in this film, as is Alex
Charlie.
Wolf.
Oh, you're talking about Peter.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Alex Wolf, who I think has been, he's left out a lot of the marketing material for the film. He's in the trailer a bit, but he's not been on any posters or anything. And I think he was one of my big surprises of the film, not just about how much he's in it, but about how great he is in this.
It seems to me as though he learned a lot from Toni Collette during the shoot. I see so much physical acting from him in this film, whether it was Ari Aster's direction or him taking this on board. But yeah, it demands a lot from him. And he's very, very good. I mean, it's hard to stand up next to someone like Toni Collette and hold your own.
Yeah.
I think he does. I was surprised by how much prominence he was given in the film, because like you said, he's been left off the marketing quite a bit.
The scene with him and her arguing at the dinner table is like, for me, that's like Leland Palmer and Twin Peaks, like Fire Walk With Me, family issues.
Yeah.
Like, that was just the most brilliant. I think it's one of the best scenes of the film. And it pardon me, it illustrates like that melodramatic edge as well. It's a family drama. It's not a straight out horror film.
And
that scene was just unbelievable between the two of them.
I think that works really well in the film's favour, because you have all of this family drama and you have all of this stuff to cling on to. And it is quite a slow burner, but it takes all that time to build up this family and these characters that we get to know really well. And then that pays off so well in the third act, because we actually care about who they are and they're not just kind of like teenagers running around being murdered, or I don't really.
Yeah.
But like something that actually gives you something to cling on to makes it scarier.
You're right. Maybe that's the kind of way that this auteur-driven horror cinema is going, in that it's just so character-focused. Mm. And it is a massive change from the 80s and maybe the early 90s, when it was very much kind of bodies to be killed. Mm. That's what we thought was scary. Even the early 2000s with the torture porn movies, they were bodies to be killed on screen. That was the fear. And I think, you know, back in the 70s, it wasn't like that. I think we're getting to that point now again. I think you're right, where it's very, very character focused, and it's scarier. It's all the scarier for it.
Yeah, I think if you can see something of yourself in one of the characters on screen, that is terrifying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned Little Charlie back there, who's played by Molly Shapiro. Introducing Molly Shapiro, she's credited as, so this is her first big role.
Yeah, I was reading she played Matilda on stage, which really impressed me. Mm. I thought that's such a different role to what she's playing here.
Yeah, she's got such a presence in this film, and I'm terrified of her.
Yeah, she joined the kind of legendary creepy kids on screen. She's totally in control of her performance for such a young actor.
She reminded me a little bit, and it's only, I'm just trying to find the name now, but Millicent Simmons, the girl from A Quiet Place.
The
little girl in A Quiet Place. Yeah, yeah. Who, again, like, I mean, the characters are completely different, but just in terms of being an absolutely standout part of the film and just being like an amazing actress at such a young age and really like standing against, like, you know, in A Quiet Place, but also like with Hereditary, like standing against Gabriel Byrne and Toni Collette. Like, these are not small actors. And you really want to watch her. Mm-hmm. You know, you really want to see what's going on. Also, she's so creepy. Yeah. Like, from the second you see her, she is like the creepiest thing ever. She's like, it's got that that kind of gothic, that like old school gothic thing that like Christina Ricci used to have or something like that. Like, it was just like, you know, there's something weird about her.
Yeah, but Christina Ricci, she was like my crush as a 12-year-old.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So we've spoken about a few of the influences on the film. You've talked about it a bit as well, both all of us actually, about this kind of old school, like 60s, 70s American horror filmmaking. So we mentioned The Exorcist numerous amounts of times. Rosemary's Baby, I think, is another one. The Babadook, I think, as well, is a big influence. Weirdly enough, Paranormal Activity 3. Has anyone seen Paranormal Activity
3? I saw the film. I haven't. Go on. What did you think of Paranormal Activity 3?
It did remind me a little bit, just in kind of payoff at the end. But that was more fun to watch as a group, I think. I watched that at uni in a house and then had to walk home in the dark, and it was horrible. Similar in the kind of family.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, what happened at the end?
I'm trying to think of a horror film that's gained traction in the last 10 years that hasn't been about family, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about things like Raw,
Witch.
Yeah, The Witch. They all contain great, great child performances as well. And of course, so did The Exorcist. Rosemary's Baby, not so much. And Don't Look Now, not so much. I think they were very adult focused, but they were still very much about family.
Yeah, Don't Look Now there are a lot of references to Don't Look Now, apparently, according to Ari Aster.
And do you see any red jackets? I didn't see any red jackets.
Yeah, I can't think what they could be.
But I mean, he obviously during the interview talked about all of his influences, and he also talked about how he'd watched how he'd been into horror from a very young age. And I think that's I don't know about you guys, but I mean, it was the same for me.
Absolutely,
it was one of my entranceways into cinema was through horror, because it was kind of easier to watch, I guess, in a way. And it was easier to kind of get what the filmmakers were doing with horror, because it's such a kind of singular experience.
Yeah, something within the film itself that I noticed, that the way certain shots are framed, they're very wide and there's so much going on in them. I've seen some people on Twitter comparing it to like how a Baroque painting is shown, where you like have so many different points of focus, so much happening at once, that your eye, there's too much for your eye to take in at once. So the shots seem to really linger in this film. And I think it goes back to what you were saying, Steph, at the beginning about how there aren't really jump scares in this film. And that the frame is inviting you to stay with it rather than look away. I know you want to look away, but you're also searching. There's one moment in particular where it's looking at something for a really long time. It takes your eyes a while to focus on what is actually going on in the background. And that was when, that was when I heard people go, oh no.
Near the start of the film, was that?
No, this is towards the end.
I think somebody in my screening dropped a wine glass and they realised what's going on. But yeah, I think that's really one of the strong points of the film, is that it kind of reflects when you wake up in the middle of the night and you're looking around your room and you see shapes in stuff. It's not there, but it's like you see a coat on the back of the door and you're like, what is that? Who's in my room? But yeah, it definitely plays on that kind of experience that probably everybody has had of just like trying to see things in shadows and you're not sure if it's there or not.
I've subsequently read quite a lot of, well, I tried not to read many reviews before seeing the film, but then having read a couple of people afterwards from all over the world who have seen it, and a lot of people have said on a second viewing, it's probably scarier because you kind of know a little bit about like what's going on. So you're not kind of just thrown into it a little bit. But it's, as you say, like you actually have a bit more to explore. You're not just trying to see what Toni Collette's doing, or, you know, you're trying to see like what's in the background a little bit more, and you're trying to piece it together and also like pick up the pieces along the way. Because if you think back on it, like I said it before, like it's such an intelligent film. Like it never not tells you what's going on. But you don't necessarily realise you're being told all these elements until you got to the end.
Yeah.
So I reckon, like, I mean, I'd love to watch it a second time and be like, oh, wait, actually, no, do you know what? I missed that. Like, that's really obvious now. But actually, like, and I think that's what really makes it. And those shots are like, they're so layered. There's so much in them. Like, how deep each shot is. Like, how the frames themselves, they just go so far back. And I think it has a lot to do with the house. And that location is the most brilliant location. Like when you first see it from the outside and you're like, oh, it's just like a house in the middle of the woods. We've never seen this before. But actually, like, they use it so well because it's not just used as a device for them to be out by themselves. There's actually stuff hidden everywhere along the way in all the different layers. I know I'm using my hands to illustrate and no one can see on podcasts what I'm actually illustrating. But like, there's just so much in all the shots.
Yeah.
And I think that's, as we've said it several times, like, it's a director who genuinely understands the form so well.
Oh, absolutely.
What did we think of this motif of Annie's like dollhouses? What did we think of that? How did that play in?
I loved that. I think it starts to kind of mix in every now and again. They'll do these kind of tilt shift shots where you're not sure if you're looking at a miniature or if you're looking at the real. Like the real house or the real thing. And there's so many good kind of cross-section shots of, I think it's when they like bury her mother and it goes down. And you see it like go down underground, and it just feels like you're looking at a miniature for the whole film. Like it could be all happening in like one miniature house.
That was the moment for me with the grave where I thought, oh, this film's this is doing something different here. This is actually going to be really interesting to see how they do this.
I actually found the miniatures like probably part like one of the scariest elements of the film. Like, I don't know whether it's just like me, like I don't know if dollhouses scare me or something. Maybe that's something I've just discovered about myself. But like, there was one of the miniatures where I'm assuming it must be her mother is standing in the doorway. And they're in bed, but it's a miniature. I was expecting at any point for something to happen, a jump scare, but I was expecting it. And even though I was expecting it, I knew I was still going to jump out of my seat. And I was still just like watching that scene behind my hand, just being like, this is horrifying.
Yeah.
But it's the tension, because there's no talking over the top. There's no, you know, you're really given that time to look and watch and just wait.
And I think those shots where she's working so closely on the miniatures as well, because it's so tightly framed and you're just looking at that one thing, I feel like you expect her to look up and someone's going to be standing in front of or something like that. So yeah, you're constantly on edge looking at these tiny miniatures thinking, the rest of the world is behind you. What's happening?
It's very true. Or they're going to move. I was expecting one of them to move at some point. I know that's from a different horror film, clearly. But because it lingers on them for so long, you're thinking, oh, the mum figure's going to like move, or it's going to smile or something. But it doesn't. It's almost worse that it doesn't, because then you're, like you said earlier, you're left without this release, and the tension's just passed over to the next scene.
Yeah.
There's also this nice mirroring between the dollhouse and what's happening to the family, in that they're not in control of what happens in their house, and there's an outside force that's moving things around and doing things to them and this and that. So it's a nice kind of parallel.
That did ruin Paddington for me, to be honest, though. Do you know when they have the doll's house in Paddington?
Yeah.
Can't look at dioramas anymore.
They were always creepy. I'm with Ollie on this one. Ban doll houses. Okay, so we haven't talked about Gabriel Byrne at all. So he plays Steve, who's the father of the family. And he's got a really interesting role, actually, because he doesn't share in their bloodline. So he's kind of sort of almost an outsider in his own home. And I think that comes across really well, I thought. And he's got quite an interesting role. And I know it plays on this kind of tradition that it's often the female character that is convinced they're a ghost and the male character is the voice of reason. And this still has that, but it does something quite interesting with it, I thought.
Yeah, I really like Gabriel Byrne as an actor. I think his presence in the film is really interesting because of his stature as an actor and because of the fact that he's very involved in this story that's going on.
Yeah.
You expect him to have a bigger part in it. And it's kind of off-putting and scary and horrifying when he doesn't, to me. Like, I feel like he is a good audience surrogate, I feel, for this film, in that you want him to be okay. You know what I mean? He's the one that's trying to lead this family in the right direction, and he doesn't understand what they're going through. He doesn't understand what the other members of the family are going through in the same way that we don't as well. But yeah, it's an interesting piece of casting for me, and it's an interesting piece of acting for Gabriel Byrne, because in some ways I think it's a thankless role.
Yeah.
But he does it really well. Like, he does it exactly how he should. So
I was really interested with his character I really like Gabriel Byrne, and I think that he doesn't get credit where credit's due sometimes, mostly because I don't think he does many quote-unquote, big things.
No.
He doesn't do big characters. He doesn't do big films. He does a lot of television.
But
he's so subtle in the film, and he's so softly spoken throughout the whole film as well. And, like, there's a moment really near the beginning of the film when they come home from the funeral, and they all walk into the house, and he tells the whole family, make sure you take your shoes off. And there's like those slight OCD moments throughout the film, which maybe I thought that they were going to come off something, like maybe that was going to suddenly reveal something major, but they don't. And I really like that there's just this like subtle character that's just kind of almost being taken. It's exactly as you say, like he's a great surrogate for us, because he's being taken on the same journey that we're all being taken. He's not, for the most part, standing about screaming and shouting, and he's not getting involved in ghouls and hanging out with Anne Dowd's character, which no one should ever do, as we have decided on this podcast. But he always comes back. There's never a moment where he's not involved in the story. And I think that, like, it's just that small subtlety that just grounds it all a little bit. And adds to that melodramatic feel. It's a family. I hate to say this, but it's like, it's 2.4 children. It's quote unquote mummy and daddy and kids. But it grounds it a little bit and makes it something that you can see yourself in.
Yeah.
It needs him. The film needs
him. He's definitely there to kind of highlight how unusual maybe the rest of his family is behaving. There's kind of little bits and pieces where Tony Collette will go to do something and he'll be like, what are you doing?
How many times does she go to the cinema?
By
herself?
She's like a real movie buff.
Never asks her, like, what did you see?
No.
Never says to her, what did you see? You know?
So this film is an A24 film, and I think they've got a real name for themselves in general, but in like this kind of art horror film, if we can call it art horror. Last year they had It Comes at Night, which I loved. Year before that, they had The Witch, and now they've got Hereditary. And Hereditary, went further than what it was predicted to do opening weekend in America last week. And as we've all been saying, it's been everywhere. It's been talked about everywhere. This could be huge. Do you think this is a real... We're now fully... Do you think this is like the peak of this kind of new form of horror? It's going to continue for years?
I think we're not assessing horror films by just how scary they are anymore. It's about like the way that it's crafted and put together. And if Hereditary is kind of an example of that and becomes big, then I hope it makes more horror films like that.
Mm-hmm. I think we've got a new Robert Eggers film coming out from the director
The Lighthouse.
Yeah. Which is A24 as well.
Yeah. Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe.
Mm-hmm.
Black and white.
Sounds great. They're calling it a black and white dark fantasy horror film on Wikipedia. So we've got that. We've got obviously Jordan Peele's working on his film Us that's coming out, which is going to be, I think, is that still Blumhouse that are releasing that?
That's Blumhouse, I believe, yeah.
So, I mean, there's a future there already set in stone. I mean, Raw, Julie Ducanau, I think she's working on another horror film at the moment as well. So, I mean, I can't see it going away anytime soon. I think that's probably got something to do with the current state of politics and the world around us. I think horror has definitely had a history of moving in time with politics in a lot of ways. And I think that right now we're seeing this kind of like normalcy being torn apart. It seems to be something
from that, within the family.
Yeah, from within space, the family unit, from within the recognizable society.
Yeah.
We're seeing like some hideous kind of thing invading and pulling people apart. And I think that's the way that horror is headed. And there's so much that you can play around with in that regard. And I think that's really exciting.
Absolutely. So that is Hereditary, which comes out today, Friday the 15th. Also out today, we have The Happy Prince. So this is a biography about the last days of Oscar Wilde, played in the film by Rupert Everett, who directs here for the first time. The film also stars Colin Firth, Emily Watson and Tom Wilkinson, and we sent Kelly Powell to speak to Rupert Everett.
Okay, so welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We're here to talk about your new film, The Happy Prince,
yes,
which chronicles the last years of Oscar Wilde's life.
It does.
So I know that this has been a long project in the making for you. Over 10 years, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
Can you talk about what compelled you? What about the story compelled you to tell it? And maybe what about Oscar Wilde sort of resonates with you as a filmmaker and as an actor?
Well, first of all, when I started doing it, I didn't realize it was going to take 10 or 11, actually probably even more than 12 years from beginning to end. And so I don't know whether I would have... done it if I'd known how long it was going to take. But originally, when I started out, I was just trying to write myself a role that was really good and very showy and something that I felt maybe people would want to see me in. I wasn't getting so much work in those days. It was the roles I was getting were smaller and smaller and more boring in things, and I could see I was kind of fading out, and so I decided to take the law into my own hands and write a script. So I wrote it, not really with any idea of myself directing it, but the first director who I'd written it for fell out, and then the list of... I contacted about six or seven other directors, and it took me so long to get a negative answer out of all of them, but two more years, I gave up. And then I thought, well, it's dead, a script, if you don't make it. It doesn't mean anything. So I decided to make it myself. And then it took another 8 years, really, to get off the ground.
Wow, that's ages.
Mm.
Why did you choose to focus on his final years? What about these years, the sort of fall from grace that intrigued you?
Well, initially, because the other three films about Oscar Wilde, one by starring Robert Morley as Oscar Wilde, the other starring Peter Finch, and the other starring Stephen Fry. Sorry, what am I doing? I'm going crazy.
It's all right.
My brain's going to give it up.
It's all right.
They all stop.
Yeah.
When he goes into prison, and I thought, oh well, that's really for me the part where it gets interesting, and for me, the image of Oscar Wilde in Paris in the end of the 19th century, dying in a cheap hotel room, begging for drinks on the boulevard, this fallen star, living in the gutter but looking at the stars, and it just is one of the most romantic stories in that I can think of. Mm. So that was really the reason.
Okay. And you've called your film The Happy Prince, which is after the title of a short story
yes.
that he wrote for children.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask, in your opinion, how the story connects with, you know, Oscar Wilde's life and maybe death.
Well, first of all, there's a theme of children through the film. The film starts with him remembering drunk, sitting at a table in a boulevard bar. He remembers reading to his children at night in London many years ago, and he's reading them The Happy Prince. And so this reading of the story then goes on to include two boys that he meets on the street in Paris, and he kind of, he takes them over. He's having an affair with the eldest one, who's a kind of 20-year-old guy, and his younger brother, who's about 8 or 9, he makes these stories up, and he tells the story of The Happy Prince to him. And so that story runs through the film, and I called it The Happy Prince because I think in a way that Oscar was in some sense the Happy Prince as he stumbled around Paris, always seen, you know, in the mist, walking somewhere on his own a lot, but always in a good humour, funnily enough, always making jokes still, always laughing. I think he was humorous till the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you about the structure of your film, because to me it felt like it unraveled in almost like a fever dream, you know, delirious recollections of a man on his deathbed. And I wanted to know, why did you choose to tell the story in that way, and perhaps what you wanted the audiences to take from that?
Well, in a way, the story takes place in about 14 days. A man is sitting in a bar. He meets a woman. She gives him £5. He goes out and gets drunk. He falls off a table and goes to bed, has an operation on his eardrum that splits, and then dies. So it mostly takes place in this bedroom, which kind of expands and shrinks with his memories and his ramblings. He's on morphine, and he starts, as his brain kind of starts to crumble, he's reevaluating the past, really. So it goes back and forth from the bed, and he's going through his exile and seeing where it went wrong or what happened to it, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So it is like a feverish, it's a morphine dream in mm-hmm. a way.
Yeah. Okay, so the film doesn't feel at all like a generic biopic in any way. Mm. I really enjoyed it. Especially, you know, the films that we often see coming out of the US that have a particular structure to it.
Mm.
And in fact, it's felt to me decidedly European. So I wanted to ask, as a first-time director, what your influences were for this film.
When I was putting it together initially, I would joke and say I'd like it to have a Visconti meets CCTV aesthetic. And I was very affected by the films of a Belgian couple called the Dardenne brothers, and they use a lot of handheld camera work, and also they follow characters, mm-hmm. and I like the notion of the camera. What happens at the beginning of my film is Oscar Wilde looks up into the camera at the very beginning and says, "It's a dream,"
mm-hmm.
and then he gets up and the camera follows him. But what I'm hoping, not to sound too wacky, but he establishes a relationship with the camera, and the camera then becomes a kind of observer
mm-hmm.
and follows him.
You do feel that.
It follows him down into this feverish world where we watch him, you know, the end of his, it follows him down into Hades, really. And and so that was, and the Dardenne brothers have this amazing trick of filming people's backs and not their fronts. And this is a fantastic thing. Mm-hmm. And it was Andrea Arnold copied them, and I'm copying them both, it's very effective.
Yes.
And so a lot of the time I'm staying on Oscar's back, following him, going with him mm-hmm. Into the next part of the adventure.
Amazing. So what was it like to direct yourself in this lead role that you resonate with so deeply?
Oh, I really enjoyed working with me as a director. to be honest, I mean, yes, I'm not being just funny, but yeah. I did. Okay. I felt that because I gave myself a lot of attention in the edit, mm-hmm. And I made my performance a lot better. And so I very much appreciated that on behalf of me, the actor. And I think if I ever had a piece of advice to give to an actor is make sure the director loves you. Because if the director doesn't like you, he's not ever going to bother to go through every moment of your bit of film and see if he can bring out the best bit of the film. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do so much with an actor's performance in the edit. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable.
And as an actor, was it important for you to play Oscar, you know, and sentimentally? Sort of, kind of, because you do get like a sort of real sense of who he was, you know, you're not scared to show his flaws as well as his genius.
I think his flaws are the things that I find the most touching about him, because mm-hmm. the flaws that all human beings have, really. Mm. And so I think he's a typical human. I think he's quite an emotional character in it. I just didn't want it to be, you know, like a Walt Disney film, mm-hmm. in a way.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so Oscar Wilde hugely valued the role of art in society. And I wanted to ask you if you can maybe talk about your ideas around this, and perhaps is it important for you to have a message with your filmmaking?
I think messaging is quite scary, because it's rather patronizing to have a message. I feel that filmmaking really is about your own passion about a subject, and you just do it because you want to do it. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to second guess or to mold it into a manipulation that kind of manipulates a response from people, I find that's a lot of what modern cinema is about, in a way. You know, it's about focus grouping things and trying to make films work for a certain group of mythical people. And I think that's not really very creative. I think the kind of world that I was brought up in, or the world that I became first aware of cinema in, was a much smaller world in which you heard about the new film by Fellini, or the new film by Truffaut, or the new this, or the new that. And you went to see that because you were interested in what they were thinking, not some marketed piece of processed celluloid that some, you know, focus groups have decided is what people want to see.
Yeah.
So I don't know about a message to my film. The only message I can think of is that I have an enormous fascination and affection for Oscar Wilde. To me, in my life, particularly as a gay man working in a rigorously heterosexual world, Oscar to me is a great source of inspiration. All I can hope is that inspiration somehow goes across the footlights, mm-hmm. and into the hearts of the audience. But beyond that, mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to patronize my audience into trying to think that I'm the person to give them messages.
That's fair.
I mean, the only message is try and go and see the film.
Yes, you should go see the film. It's
go
very
and see
good.
The film.
So in closing, you can tell that this is a passion project. Obviously, it's come from your heart, and it comes across on screen, both in your performance and in your direction. But have you got anything else in the pipeline as the director?
Yes, I've got millions of other things. But I'm also a realist, and maybe I'm too old, maybe this is a one-off, I don't know. But yes, I do have millions of plans. New horizons have suddenly appeared before me, and I want to jump back on my old pony and gallop off into the distance.
Particularly as a director.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as a director of me.
that's great.
Because I feel I've got a lot more potential as an actor than I've ever had with any other director.
That's amazing. I love that.
Only because I don't think any other director liked me very much.
No.
One did. PJ Hogan adored me, but so many directors didn't like me. And I feel Rude. Like actors, when they go to see films, quite often they say to each other, this is a very normal conversation. Why did you choose that bit? It was so, do you remember that other bit? And we all go, yes, you were so good in that bit. And when you come to the edit yourself, you can see how that happens.
Did you have to separate yourself, though, as like, were you looking for particularly the best take, or were you looking for what worked in the sort of grander scheme of the thing, you know?
Looking for the best take and what was the best for the character.
Yes.
And, you know, you can, and also you can jig it around to such an extent that you can make everything so much better.
Yeah.
And so I would love to have another chance to work with me again as the director, just to, you know, because I think I could do some other things that were also surprising.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you get the opportunity
to do that.
Thank
you very much. I do too.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank
and your
you very much.
And we hope to see you again.
Yes, see you at the Curzon.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was great.
Okay, so that's Happy Prince, which is out today on Friday the 15th. But if you feel like staying home this weekend, on Curzon Home Cinema, we'll also be getting Dark River, Clio Barnard's film, which we spoke about on the podcast a few months ago now. So do go back and check out that episode where I spoke to Clio Barnard. But to tie into Hereditary, Curzon Home Cinema has a new collection called Scary As F Star Star Star. So this collection includes Suspiria, the Dario Argento original. Did everyone see the Suspiria trailer?
I did.
Oh my God, I'm so excited.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. I was a big skeptic of that new film existing, but after this trailer, I think I'm a little bit more excited.
It looks so grainy and nice.
Yeah, it looks different.
And if you haven't seen the original, go and watch it. Like, seriously, go and watch it on the best sound system and screen that you can.
That's a phenomenally weird film.
Yeah.
Also on there is Audition, Takashi Miike's film, just as horrible as Hereditary. It Follows, which we spoke about earlier, American Psycho, Let the Right One In, The Blair Witch Project, A Bay of Blood, Goodnight Mommy, and The Babadook. So a great collection.
Sounds like a good weekend.
Yeah.
Really good.
Excellent. So if you have any thoughts on Hereditary, do let us know, or The Happy Prince, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com for next week's show. And as ever, please subscribe, leave a review or comment. We're available every Friday on iTunes and Acast. So that's goodbye from Steph.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Stephen.
Bye-bye.
And goodbye from Ollie.
Goodbye.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Scuttle back into your corner now.
That ceiling's great.
Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.